Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
It's the one-year look-back window beginning today for victims and survivors of child sex abuse across New York State. And we're looking at the local impact this morning. Two guests in studio. Joining us is attorney Steve Boyd from the law firm of Steve Boyd and also James Faluzak. James is a survivor. He's also a priest, a former priest as well. James, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What does today mean for you?
It's a day of victory in many respects for the countless and voiceless victims of clergy sexual abuse that now we can force discovery of their histories, the histories of their abusers, and help them even begin to reconstitute what they've lost as a result of this tragedy. So in a certain sense, yeah, a day of victory, but you watch the images of the survivors who have filed so far, and they're breaking down in front of all of us on television. And so yesterday I spent some time fielding calls from some of the folks that I work with directly and some of the survivors that we all know, just because it's not easy by any stretch of the imagination to recall this type of material.
We have the two of you in studio for a brief period of time together, and I'm hoping we can kind of go into the relationship that an abuse survivor would have with an attorney. That has to be a tough thing to take that step to go to an attorney in the first place. James, I guess, how do other survivors, how do you make that decision of who to trust, when to go to somebody?
Over about three decades, I told some family members, some friends, the priests that were assigned to me in my training at Christ the King Seminary, but I didn't really stand up and attempt to take action until I was really just about 39, 40 years old. And frankly, a lawyer was one of the last people that I considered going to. Now, that was my experience. As I accompany victims through this process now in Buffalo for about 2 years, I see oftentimes it's an attorney that is the first person and perhaps sometimes the only person that a victim is willing to confide in. And I think that speaks in part to, you know, someone like Steve Boyd, who we stand on his shoulders as somebody who investigated these matters back in the early 90s. I remember him doing that well at Christ the King Seminary when Father John Aurelio was my homiletics professor. And so you have all of this this baggage and preconceived notions of how people are going to react. And, you know, here in Buffalo, I think we have an array of compassionate advocates. And so I'm seeing again and again, victims are speaking to me or to Paul Barr, who I work with, or to Steve or others. Oftentimes, they're the very first person they speak to.
Do you think there's strength in numbers, James, that people are going to watch what's happening today? People who haven't had that courage to come forward, people who are struggling with this and have been maybe for decades, to see what's happening today and to say, you know what, I think I can do it now.
2 years ago, the group that meets regularly in Buffalo, this is before there was any renewed media notoriety, we would gather periodically, maybe about once a month, to share our stories and have some fellowship together. But 2 years ago, this past January, about a year ago last January, we were wondering if this was ever going to break again. if we were going to ever pick up where we left off in the mid-90s, fast forward to a year ago today, I sat next to Attorney General Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania as he released the grand jury report there. And those of us who were in that room on the stage with the Attorney General, we speak about ourselves, about each other, as if we are family. And so, yes, absolutely. It's a long answer to the question, but it doesn't happen overnight. But there is a sense of community and a sense of family that, has built up among us survivors.
Steve, how much of a difference does somebody like James make? Because it's one thing for you or another attorney to say, hey, if this happened to you, you know, I can help you out. Come see me. But to have somebody who actually went through that guide people through the process, that has to be something different.
I think it is, and I think that what we see is the survivors who have been able to come forward, people like James, it takes such courage to do that and to have your face and your name shown. They give power to those other people that haven't been able to come forward. One of the things I want to point out, and it goes to your earlier question, is that I've never seen such cooperation among plaintiff's lawyers. We're usually trying to compete with each other and get the cases, but Paul Barr, who works with James and I, we're on the phone 4 or 5 times a week supporting each other because of the things that we've heard, strategizing with each other, and he's trying to help me with my clients. I'm trying to help him with his clients, and that's true with Mitch Garabedian and of course, Jeff Anderson. We're all kind of a community of plaintiff's lawyers. We know that at some point we're going to have to work together, and so far we've all been working together really well.
Is there anything to compare this to, this one-year look-back window with you guys?
I was thinking about that last night when we filed the first cases. I was looking around thinking, you're witnessing history, because we've never witnessed a time where it was a window where all of these cases that have built up over these years can now be filed on this day. And so today is really a historic day for not only for the New York court system, because it, I'm sure, is getting overwhelmed with the number of cases filed, but it's a historic day for the people like James and others who worked so hard for so long to open those courthouse doors.
One last thing for you, Steve, before we let you go. That one-year window, a lot of attention on those cases today, over 90 against the Diocese of Buffalo, and I'm sure those are cases that, and you know, some you've worked on for years and years leading up to this point. But there is a year, right? So if somebody has not reached out to you or somebody else yet, there is that year to, you know, take action.
I had a conversation with Paul when the act was passed and they had a 6-month delay. And one of us said to the other, that 6 months is going to pass by in 2 minutes. And that conversation seems like it took 2 minutes ago. So this year is going to go fast. And there were people coming in and calling and contacting us right up until 9 o'clock last night, hoping we could file on the 14th. We hope that people will come forward earlier so that we can put their cases forward and we can begin the discovery process for them.
James, you've mentioned that we've heard victory this morning, validation. When you see that over 90 cases have been filed since midnight against the Buffalo Diocese, what does that say to you?
Working with many of these victims now for almost 2 years, those of us who speak publicly also have a view behind the scenes to many of these folks who are suffering, who never come forward. And to me, seeing this vast volume filing in such a short period of time is very dramatic, but it's also not surprising. While these allegations and priests who have been named have been released by the diocese over the last year, we always knew those numbers were low. And we knew that for a reason, and that was because we've been working with many of these clients now for months, if not years.
I think people who listen to this station, people who watch the news, who have been paying attention to this, know your name. They know maybe a few other faces who have been very outspoken about the abuse that happened to them in the past, but not everybody is willing to do that. Not everybody wants to go in front of cameras and say what happened to them. They prefer to keep that to themselves. Do you think this number maybe nine. We're talking 90 cases against one diocese in one county in just over 7 hours. All these were filed. Is that going to be maybe the eye opener for a lot of people to say, okay, this isn't just a few here and there. This is a whole widespread issue.
There clearly is strength in numbers. And that's what we're seeing, I think, with this mass filing happening early on here. The estimates are much more than in the tens of cases. Our firms that I work with as an investigator are pursuing 50 cases ourselves right now. There are likely going to be a total of at least 300 cases against the Diocese of Buffalo, I would suggest. Now, that's my unvarnished, non-expert assessment, but that's the way, that's the direction I think that these numbers are heading.
James, I want to ask you if you heard or saw the Bishop's video message last night. He declined interviews, but Bishop Malone did offer a video apology to the diocese. And he also said in that statement that children in the church are safe today. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's a nice sentiment that the Bishop of Buffalo has offered us. It's what we would like to hear from him. But we are in this moment today because historically, children have not been safe within the Diocese of Buffalo. And we are hearing the revelation of some new priest abusers who are alleged to have abused that have never been named before, some of whom are even still in ministry. And so we don't really take that that seriously from Bishop Malone. We are in this present moment, and it has been so botched, I hate to put it that way, by this bishop, that so much more hurt and re-victimization has happened because of the callousness of the church, but also because of his willingness to keep some people in ministry when he should not have.
Do you know of priests still in ministry who have been accused, who might be named in some of these suits, or at least you have spoken with their accusers?
There are five clients that I've worked with in my capacity as an advocate and an investigator with both Finizi and Barr attorneys in Niagara Falls and Phillips and Palicelli in Manhattan. And we, along with all of the other cases that we intend to file, most of which cover names of abusers that have been released before, we have five today that we are prepared to name for the first time.
You're holding a news conference in about an hour, and this is when you're going to announce this?
Yes. I'm prepared to say a few words now, if time would permit. The first two are deceased. One is Father Edwin Fagowski, who is alleged to have sexually molested our client at St. Benedict Church in Bennington, New York. The second is also deceased, the longtime pastor of Holy Cross Church in Buffalo, Monsignor Joseph Gambino, who is alleged in 1948 to have sexually molested our client at the church there. I think surprisingly to some folks, we are prepared to file against Father Paul Nagaro, who is living and currently serving at St. Stephen's Church in Grand Island, New York. He is alleged to have sexually molested our client while that client was a student at St. Mary's of Sorrows Church. Perhaps shockingly, because Father Peter Popadick was the long-serving secretary to Bishop Edward Head, he is living and currently serving at St. Aloysius Gonzaga Parish in Buffalo. And in our filing, we are alleging that he sexually molested our client while he was a freshman at Bishop Fallon High School. And fifth, still living but no longer in ministry, is Franklin J. Tuckles, who over multiple years is alleged to have sexually molested our client, beginning again at St. Mary of Sorrows Church, but extending to multiple locations, including what was then St. John Vianney Seminary, now Christ the King Seminary, in various churches and private residences. And so while we go to some form of trial and seek discovery of these matters, our information and belief up to this point suggests that, yes, there are priests in the Diocese of Buffalo with allegations against them who are continuing to serve.
Are these allegations that you just mentioned something that you believe the diocese would have been aware of?
I can't speak to that for a couple of reasons, but I think in all of these cases, as I said, a year ago today, they released the grand jury report in Pennsylvania. And if you bracket out what Father Martin did to me, or the couple of other priests who tried to groom me and also abuse me, if you factor that out of my testimony, I still gave the Attorney General of Pennsylvania the names of over 100 witnesses, perpetrators, people who could attest to the testimony that I was offering. That was all information that I knew as a rank and file priest. Father Peter Popadyk, having been so close to Bishop Head, who the revelations there of cover-up are extensive and well-known now, he was not a rank and file priest. He was a chancery secretary. And I think most priests are aware of their brothers in ministry who have engaged in either some form of extracurricular activity outside of their vows, which sometimes has given cover to this criminal activity that now we're seeking to redress as a result of the Child Victims Act.
What is the where does this stand right now with these five? Are you filing a suit against the diocese over these five, or are you just naming them? Where does that stand?
Well, we are in the process of filing. That process began at 12:01 today, as we all know. And while we're not doing everything in a single batch, everything that I've just spoken to you is part of this filing. And we are going to go to the mat to defend the needs of our clients as they seek to get more information and bring more about these priests to light, so that perhaps other victims who are sitting by themselves in their suffering for decades at a time, perhaps, may now have the courage to finally speak up that these men in power have finally been named.
Hey, one last question for you before we let you go. I know you've got to run to that news conference we've been mentioning, but we hear in cases from the diocese where they will remove a priest from ministry, and then maybe it's a couple months later come back and say, you know, that some of these accusations are credible, and then that some are not credible, and the priest is returned to ministry. I'm wondering their definition of an allegation of abuse that's not credible. How do you think they view that? How might it differ from your definition of an allegation that is not credible?
I can't even begin to speak to the criteria that this bishop or this diocese uses to evaluate these matters, because they are governed by the internal proceedings of their church tribunals. The public will never know the full extent of these internal processes. Now, there may be documents that come out. There may be revelations that a whistleblower offers, or in the last week, the diocese may free up certain of its employees to address these matters. But that's all from the standpoint of a canonical church, ecclesiastical court, or an ecclesiastical internal investigation. And so what we're doing, and this is, I think, the ultimate standard that you see in any case, whether it be criminal or civil, but we have to show a preponderance of evidence, at least to establish the timing of a priest's assignment to a certain parish, or the timing of the child making the allegation, recollecting something from when they were very young, clouded by years of perhaps even internal denial and self-medication, perhaps, and all kinds of coping mechanisms. And so the work that I do principally is trying to draw out every little fact that I can both from what's publicly available, but especially from the experience of the victims that I'm working with.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.